Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as the Paralympic Games draw to a close in London, we look at their lasting legacy for all those living with disability. And the Abbey of St. Paul's outside the walls here in Rome plays host to a major colloquium exploring the writings of the Apostle of the Gentiles. London 2012 Paralympic Games draw to a close this weekend after an extraordinarily successful 10 days of events that have seen the participation of well over 4,000 disabled athletes from countries right across the globe. The Games, which opened with a spectacular ceremony on August 29th, have seen the largest participation ever, not only of athletes and coaches in some 20 different sporting disciplines, but they've also enjoyed the largest numbers of spectators and most impressive media coverage, reflecting a new interest in the achievements of Paralympian men and women. In a sense, the Games also marked a spiritual homecoming, since the idea of competitive sports for disabled athletes was launched in the British Stoke Mandeville Hospital in the years immediately following the Second World War. The first event, an archery competition, was organised for war veterans to coincide with the opening of the 1948 Summer Olympic Games, also held in the British capital that year. After the closing ceremony on Sunday, as the athletes return home, organisers and others are promising the legacy of these games will continue far into the future. The Olympic Park itself will be transformed and next summer is scheduled to reopen as a sports and entertainment complex, hoping to attract over 9 million visitors a year. The huge eye-catching steel sculpture by artist Anish Kapoor, like it or hate it, is Britain's largest piece of public art, offering visitors fantastic views across London, on a clear day that is. But beyond the infrastructure and undoubtedly positive experience of so many during these games, how much will these Paralympics really serve to change attitudes and challenge commonly held prejudices about disability in our modern societies? Well, I put those questions to James Parker, the Catholic coordinator for the 2012 London Olympic and Paralympic Games.
I've had the great honour of being the first ever lay Catholic chaplain to serve at the Paralympic Games, which, of course, is that heavily guarded home to all the athletes and officials alongside the Olympic Park. And it really is a sacred place. Why do I say this? Because the Paralympic Village is strewn with wheelchairs, crutches, bodies of every shape, size, and so-called disfigurement imaginable, if you like. And yet there's a stronger sense of community and a vibrant, tangible passion for life that not even the greatest town or city of the world could boast. I mean, the joy there really is palpable. It's a place where everybody's celebrated, everybody's honoured, and everybody's in service of one another. It really is quite extraordinary. And I'm constantly reminded there of the words of St. Lawrence when, back in the year 258, he was commanded by the Emperor Valerian to bring the church's treasury to him. And it was days later that St. Lawrence brought the poor and the crippled and the maimed before the emperor, and he stated, "Behold the jewels of the church." And yet for such a simple action, he was martyred. You know, we see the word superhumans on our billboards around Britain itself. And yet, speaking to the Paralympians, they themselves would say that they're no different to any other human being. They just wish the opportunity to be equal and to live as full a life as anybody else would. Yes, they often have greater degrees of adversity to overcome. But in all honesty, this is an aspect of any life that truly wishes to be lived to the full.
These Paralympic Games have been particularly important, haven't they, as they've been really the first occasion in which the Olympics and the Paralympics have been marked together as a celebration of sport, as you say, whatever the disability.
Absolutely. I mean, what's been wonderful and very historic is this is the first time that the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games have been organised by the very same committee. LOCOG, the London Organising Committee of the Olympic Games, refused to have two separate departments, one for sort of Paralympics and one for Olympics. They said, no, you know, the same team that serves the Olympics must be the same team that serves the Paralympics. And so there has been, in a sense, a dovetailing, a unifying work that's been taking place at the very sort of basic or foundational level of the Games itself. And hopefully, and this is very much been, we've seen this in the past week, this is what is sort of being manifest to the Games themselves. The Paralympics isn't the sort of the younger brother or the lesser cousin in some way or other. But both of these are being given the same profile, the same value, and really the same recognition that they both deserve.
And that's certainly been reflected in attitudes there, hasn't it? I mean, I understand that for the first time ever, the tickets for the Paralympics were sold out long before the Games started. Has it been possible for people to get in, all those who wanted to?
It clearly hasn't been possible for everybody who's wanted to go to be able to go. I don't know whether this is just because of the astounding achievements and, in a sense, performances that we've seen from many of the athletes through the Paralympic Games. But in my own role linked with both the Paralympic and the Olympic Games, I've had phenomenally more telephone calls from people wanting to try and obtain tickets to attend the Paralympic Games, more so ever than with the Olympic Games. And I think that shows people's passion and their desire to be able to support the Paralympics and all that the Paralympics are about, which is about engaging with those values that reject discrimination and honour determination, look for the sense of inclusivity, the sense of equality, and the creativeness that comes out and is manifest through the Paralympic Games themselves as well.
This, as you say, has been an extraordinary summer for the Olympics, in particular for these Paralympics. How do you keep that momentum going, do you think, once it's all over? And how much is it really going to change attitudes, not just in the UK, but also in those countries where stigma is still such a huge problem for those with disability?
Well, I mean, we've got two or three different things that we're looking at But engaging with as legacy. And one of those is we're in conversation at the moment with a group down in Haiti, the poorest nation of the world, which, as we all know, has experienced two horrendous earthquakes and has left many, many people there maimed and disabled. And so they probably have the highest percentage of amputees there per capita. They've got a wonderful football team called Team Zarian. The word Zarian is Creole for tarantula. When a tarantula loses its leg, it keeps on going. It acts as though life is normal. And Team Zarian are planning to come over to the UK and to tour the UK so that there's a real sense in which we continue to open the eyes, particularly of the younger generation, to the fact that any form of disability, one, shouldn't be discriminated against, but secondly, it shouldn't be seen as holding back people's lives. And I think this is one of the greatest messages that the Paralympics themselves are literally screaming at our young people here across Britain and, yes, across the world itself, is saying that, you know, just because your body isn't so-called an abled body doesn't mean that you can't achieve the same things as other people. And in some cases, actually, you can be a witness to the fact that every single human life is valuable, contains potential, and that potential needs to be discovered, to be engaged with, and to be achieved, and then, as importantly, to be celebrated. And that's something that we are, I hope that Britain itself, this is the message that it will give to the rest of the world, and that it will lead the way itself once the Games themselves are finished. I just might say that I think also that what is stirring people, certainly the Christian community across the UK, and I hope this is something that we embrace, engage with and move forward, is that we need as a whole, along with others who share our beliefs on the dignity of human life, we need to continue to take the lead, like St. Lawrence, to stridently work towards changing Britain's discriminatory and outdated abortion laws. And if this issue is not addressed as we wave goodbye to the Paralympic Games from our shores, then it's hard to imagine when another opportunity of this sort will pass our way, when society as a whole is celebrating the incredulous achievements of the people with disabilities. And if we don't address these laws, then in a couple of decades' time, Britain won't be able to provide the extensive variation of Paralympic athletes that we're providing today to be able to compete in Paralympic Games.
This work that you've been doing there, these teams of chaplains, they've been providing a very visible witness of Catholic or indeed Christian or faith presence there at the Games. How do you think this can be continued, in a sense, after it's all over?
Well, we're quite fortunate, or perhaps even more appropriate to say is blessed, is that we have the 2014 Commonwealth Games coming up in 2 years' time. The following year, we have England will host the Rugby World Cup. 2 years later, 2017, we have the World International Athletics, and then the Cricket World Cup in 2019. And so the relationships that we have been building, we have already made a commitment that we will continue to work together, both to serve the sporting world and as a way of to listen to what the sporting world can teach us as faith communities as a whole. Because it's very, very clear to me, certainly within the Olympic Village and now in the Paralympic Village, that the variation of people from the world, many of whom are often outside of the Paralympic or Olympic Villages, seem to be, in a sense, enemies of one another, but they can live side by side with one another through sport. A great example of that was on the evening of the opening ceremony of the Paralympic Games, when the large Iranian team was wheeled past and walked past the British team of Paralympians, and they both seriously cheered each other. Their voices were raised with extensive clapping, and I looked and thought, when and where would I see Britain cheering and applauding Iran? Or Iran, indeed, cheering and applauding Britain. And so we need to take very seriously what these games are teaching us and to continue to keep rolling these out with events in our own land, but also in countries across the world that host global sporting events.
Finally, I'm just going to ask you, James, to give me, if you could, a kind of personal reflection on the work that you've been doing there. You've had this very privileged position as a chaplain, a lay chaplain to the athletes and their teams. Can you give me some idea of the kind of work you've been doing, the kind of stories that you've encountered during this time?
Overall, people aren't aware that chaplaincy exists. So for many people to actually realize that their spiritual needs are being provided for, not just in the Paralympic Village, but this time around in the Olympic Park itself, for the spectators, the officials, the volunteers, people who work there. And what strikes me above all is that degree of hunger that exists within the human spirit to know and to be known, to love and to be loved. And really looking at the words of Professor Stephen Hawkins at the opening ceremony of the Paralympics, and even as a physicist and a scientist, he speaks something that very much resonates within every human spirit and in a sense comes off the pages, if you like, from the Word of God. And he says this, he said, there's no such thing as a standard or run-of-the-mill human being, but we all share the same spirit. However difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. So let us begin to celebrate excellence, friendship, and respect. And he goes on to say that we must not look at our feet, but to look upwards towards the stars. And for us, that means towards God himself through the person of Jesus Christ.
My thanks there to James Parker, the Catholic coordinator for the 2012 London Olympic and Paralympic Games. St. Paul, his life, his legacy, and his writings will be at the centre of a major meeting taking place from next Tuesday at the Rome Abbey of St. Paul's outside the walls. This 22nd Ecumenical Pauline Colloquium, to use its full title, will include some 30 top scholars from around the world under the presidency of Professor Christopher Tuckett of Oxford University. This year, the experts will be exploring Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, one of the shorter and lesser known of the 13 epistles attributed to the Apostle of the Gentiles. While mostly held behind closed doors within the ancient Benedictine Abbey, there will be a public lecture on Friday at the conclusion of the colloquium, revealing some of the fruits of the five-day meeting. So what will be some key areas of discussion, and why does the figure of Paul continue to hold such fascination for Christians across all the different denominations?
It's true to say that Paul is the great missionary of the church. The thousands of kilometres he covered, the way he wrote about what he was doing.
Benedictine Father Edmund Power is the abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls. I sat down with him to find out more about this series of Pauline encounters, which began half a century ago, back at the times of the Second Vatican Council.
That's right. I suppose it was born in the fervour of Vatican II, which of course was proclaimed here at St. Paul's. And from the 1960s right up until today, every second year, we've held the Colloquium Paulinum, as you say, with a view to studying the works attributed to St. Paul.
You have top Pauline scholars coming in, don't you, from all over the world and from different Christian denominations?
That's right. Part of the inspiration from the start was that it should be international, that it should be ecumenical, and that it should be men and women. In fact, it's been more difficult finding a large number of female scholars, but we've got several. So from that period, from the 60s onwards, we've always had a group of roughly 30, 35 experts from all around the world on different aspects of Paul. And it's always a great pleasure to gather them together here in the Shrine of St. Paul.
You're looking at different aspects of his work each year and his life, aren't you? This year you're looking at Thessalonians 2.
Yes, in fact, the kind of structure of the colloquium is slightly unusual. And normally speaking, they don't study a Pauline theme, you know, a topic from his theology, but they study a particular letter. So from the very beginning, they've gone systematically through the letters of St. Paul. Each colloquium, they'll deal with one letter or one small group of letters. And when they've come to the end, there are 13 letters of St. Paul, they then begin at the beginning again. Now, you might say, well, after 13 years, is there anything new to say on the letter to the Romans? Well, obviously there is, because Pauline scholarship's constantly going forward. So it's a close study of individual texts. This year, the second letter to the Thessalonians, which is, I suppose, I'm not an expert, but I'd say not one of the great letters, they're going to study it more in the context, they're studying it, in fact, now in the context of a Pauline eschatology. In other words, Paul's view of the end of time and so on, because the second letter to the Thessalonians deals with themes of that nature.
I'm not in any way an expert either, but if I understand it, there is still some controversy about the authenticity of the authorship, if it really is Paul's letter.
You must come here on Friday evening to discover all. Because, in fact, at the end of the colloquium, it's a gathering of experts and it's very technical, but we always offer a public lecture. And one of the scholars gives the lecture in Italian. It'll be in the Basilica immediately after Vespers, and it tries to sum up some of the findings or results of the colloquium. And this year, the question that he'll be considering will be, did Paul, in fact, write the second letter to the Thessalonians?
A little bit of background, perhaps, to the context in which Paul was writing at that time.
It's difficult for me to say very much directly on 2 Thessalonians. All I can say is that I think people tend not to know it, because it's not one of the obvious ones. You know, people think of the letter to the Romans with some of its fine passages, or 1 Corinthians, the hymn to love. But 2 Thessalonians is probably, if Paul wrote it, and that we don't know, it's quite an early epistle. Normally speaking, the first letter to the Thessalonians is considered Paul's first work. So this one deals with some themes that maybe, well, I suppose the experts will say are very important, but I think the ordinary person in the street or in the basilica might wonder. So that's another good reason for coming on Friday.
Also because the question of eschatology, the end of times, is a difficult question, difficult issue for people today, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, eschatology has two senses. One is what happens after we die. The word eschatology, the Greek word, means to do with the last things. But there's also a sense in which eschatology is always present, because we're always in the presence of our ultimate destiny, which is obviously to be with God, but we're with God now. So in a sense, we're living eschaton, you could say. This double sense is very strong in the writings of St. John. But it'll be interesting to see what they turn up on St. Paul in this particular colloquium.
We have, of course, just fairly recently had a Pauline year in terms of rediscovering the contemporary relevance of the figure of St. Paul. How important do you think was that year overall?
It was a very stimulating year for us here, and I think it did have quite an impact. It finished now something like 3.5 years ago, in middle of 2009. But I remember at the time thinking that Paul is the only figure that you could actually have a year based on first. I mean, that there was the year of the priesthood immediately after, with an emphasis on St. John de Vianney. But what other saint has produced so much in terms of writings? You know, almost half the New Testament is attributed to Paul. And so his thought, his writings have been at the basis of all Christian reflection ever since. They're the earliest works of the New Testament. And so I think it was very opportune on the part of the Holy Father to call that Pauline year, which gave many people an opportunity to study Paul in greater detail, but not just at a technical level, but also at a spiritual level, to actually be moved by his writings, which are, of course, all about our relationship with Christ, which is perennially important. So you could say every year should be a year of St. Paul.
You mentioned at the beginning this is an ecumenical colloquium taking place. How important is this kind of work, this academic work, if you like, in terms of our ecumenical journey?
As I said before, I'm not a biblical expert, but I wonder how denominational differences really enter the question of technical biblical studies nowadays. Because we're dealing with the same text, it's true there'll be different shades of emphasis or interpretation. But what I notice, really, when these scholars come together, you're almost unaware of differences of denomination. They deal as equals with respect one for the other. They're studying the same text, that they're experts in the same linguistic and cultural background. And it's remarkable, really, that you're talking the same language, I think, in a way that maybe outside that sort of context, it's not quite so obvious. I must say, I notice that when we pray with other Christians, apart from the Eucharist, which is a particular problem, that there's always a tremendous sense of unity. You know, their love of Christ, our love of Christ is the same. But there are still difficulties that prevent us from being completely one. But at least in the context of Pauline studies, I think, there's a tremendous harmony.
Prayer is an important part of this colloquium as well, isn't it, on a daily basis?
Yeah, this colloquium is unusual because it's, as the people who participate in it also say, it's completely unique to meet in this context. The context is not a conference centre or a hotel or even a university. It's a monastery. And the original inspiration of the monks when they began this in the 60s was to actually pray around the tomb of St. Paul in his honour and to study his works. So there's always that kind of spiritual strand through what they do. Each day they begin, obviously, with a prayer. They participate in some of the divine office in the basilica with the monks. They eat with the monks in the refectory for lunch every day, and then they eat together in the evening separately. But they always say how much they appreciate this kind of carrying out this study of the works of Paul in a context of faith, which is welcoming and very much connected with Paul.
We're about to move into a so-called year of faith, the Synod on the New Evangelization. How much do you think Paul can or should be a focus during this forthcoming year as well?
Well, I could stick my neck out and say Paul should be the focus, but because, I mean, he's the great missionary, more than anyone else in the New Testament. We don't know all that much about the Peter, for example. There's a certain amount in the Acts of the Apostles. Or the other apostles, we know that they were involved in missionary activities. It's clear there are traditions that associate different apostles with different churches. I don't want to criticise or make demeaning comments on the Apostolic College and its missionary work, but it's true to say that Paul is the great missionary of the church. The thousands of kilometres he covered, the way he wrote about what he was doing. And so, yes, the new evangelization really should take Paul as its inspiration.
My thanks there to Abbot Edmund Power of the Benedictine Abbey of St. Paul's outside the walls here in Rome. For anyone interested in attending that public lecture at the conclusion of the Pauline Colloquium, it will be held after Vespers in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls at 6:30 on the evening of Friday, the 14th of September. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. But just before we go, a message from the head of the English Programme, Sean Patrick Lovett, about some novel ways of listening to Vatican Radio if you have an Android smartphone.
If you have an Android smartphone, then visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. The application contains an agenda that lets you access text and audio content associated with the Pope's public events, while informing you in real time about papal celebrations broadcast live. A news service provides the latest information on the Church and the world, while a radio section links you to Vatican Radio's 5 audio channels and its 40 different language services. Audio, video, text, news, editorials, live broadcasts, all in a single app. Go to our website at www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner. The version for iPhone and iPad is coming soon.
So whatever way you choose to listen to Vatican Radio, do stay tuned. Once again, that website is www.radiovaticana.va and select the English World icon. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.